into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America. No, 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 not God Bless America. God damn America, that's in the Bible, for killing innocent people. God damn America, for treating our citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
All right, hello everyone, welcome to Pod Damn America, the Gothic Socialist Podcast for the Stupid Children, etc., and so on and so forth. Like Zizek says, hi, I'm Jake. I am just Jake today. Anders is, he's got a work thing or something like that. But I am pleased to announce that I'm joined by an excellent guest today, a writer and a fellow podcaster, to talk about the movie that I'm assuming we have similar takes on, but we'll find out. Hello, welcome to the show, Kyle, aka Labor Kyle, aka Kyle. I forgot your last name already. Welcome.
That's me.
To the show.
it's Kyle Kern. I'm happy to be here. I love the show. Cue more Donkey Kong music. No, I'm very excited to join you today and to give some insight into Alex Garland's big dumb guy brain. I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about.
And if you're a fan of our show and of Left Podcasts, you may know Kyle from being the newest Mike on the Horror Vanguard, our friends over there at Horror Vanguard Podcast, and also from podcasts like AGAB, a.k.a. All Gamers Are Bastards. Very cool. That would make sense as to why you like Donkey Kong music. I get you.
Yeah, the very serious show where we only tangentially talk about video games and often talk about movies, and also a lot of jokes about jacking off. Again, very serious stuff over there.
Yeah, very serious stuff. We're doing the big work here on the podcast sphere.
Building socialism. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the glue that holds it together, my friend. I think, who said that? It was a Trotsky quote. I don't know. So anyways, we are here today to discuss Alex Garland's fucking magnum opus, Civil War. Really just because I saw you tweeting that you watched it and wanted to talk about it, and I recognized the feeling immediately. I hadn't seen it yet, but I saw it, and I was yelling at it in my head the entire time in the movie theater. I think that it's incredibly, it was bad, but in ways that make me want to dissect and discuss, because they're infuriating and so reflective of what's happening in the world.
Much like the rest of the internet.
Did you love it? I mean, am I wrong? What's going on here? What did you think of the movie?
Talking about this movie.
Yeah. But lay it on me. What was your take on this film?
So I found Civil War to be a deeply strange, deeply weird movie. That was, in terms of it as a movie itself, it's pretty standard fare. And if you're familiar with Alex Garland's body of work, which includes movies that he's written as well as novels, he started out as a novelist and then worked his way into film. He wrote, of his less recent stuff, the film that people are probably most familiar with that he wrote was 28 Days Later. Was known for his collaborations with Danny Boyle for a while. Then his, I believe his directorial debut was the movie Deus Ex, which came out in 2014. He wrote or did some story supervising for video games, wrote a couple of other movies, did an adaptation of the novel Annihilation, another very strange film in this case that I believe he described his take on Annihilation as from memory, as in, I read the book. And then some time passed, and then I wrote a screenplay based off of the book. and I find Alex Garland's whole thing to be very, very, I find him to be a deeply annoying person for a lot of reasons, but the my encounter with this film was largely the same way as everybody else. It was very heavily advertised as, it's basically A24's big like summer blockbuster. A24 wanted a big summer blockbuster, something to get people to go to movies in the theaters again. And it seems like they got their wish. I believe it's number one in the box office right now. A lot of people are seeing it. And what's more important for movies these days is a lot of fucking people are talking about it. Civil War is a movie about ethics and journalism, which is not what I expected going into it. I knew that it followed journalists, but I didn't realize that it is a movie that is deeply invested in, on the one hand, a radical centrist politics, which Alex Garland, that is straight from Alex Garland's brain. Really, the thing that told me everything I needed to know about sort of his take on the movie can be summed up in the interview that he did with Pod Save America recently.
Right. Yeah. Watching the movie, there's not that much explicitly stated in it, and you could almost get into arguments about what it was trying to say and feel like you might be wrong to come at it as a leftist and critique its liberalism. But he then, outside of the film, went on Pod Save America and explicitly stated his very bad cooked over milquetoast lib politics and said that was what it was about. So I don't think there's much of a way to pull some films you can go, I disagree with the writer, like they accidentally said something else, but this is just very heavy handed and intentionally bad.
Yeah, there's no really kind of plausible deniability there, which is fine. Like, there's what a lot of people have been invested in doing, which is both tempting and I think probably intellectually rewarding, is to try and figure out exactly what Alex Garland was trying to say in this very kind of squishy, explicitly radically centrist movie. But in his Positive America interview, like, really sums up everything that you need to know to understand his ideas, which, like, the bar was set really low, but it's maybe even dumber than I thought it was. He definitely thinks of himself as a radical and enlightened centrist. Most of what he cares about is sussing out this kind of like abstract, non-specific problem with quote unquote extremism that he likes to objectively and directly like equivocate between left and right ideas on quote unquote extremism. And so as like, you can imagine that he's in this, I know this clip went viral on Twitter, his solution to the problem of the potential civil war that he's setting up, which he sees as an actual possibility, is to, basically to vote your ass off. Like he has this like profoundly confusing take on the function of politics that like he, it was really interesting. I think to tell you, like, there was a part where whichever one of the fucking Johns was interviewing him. He said that he went and he saw the movie with a friend of his who was a journalist, and that journalist had a problem, basically a criticism of the movie, that the journalists in the film are very cold and they're very unfazed when they're filming people who are dead or dying or in the middle of combat. And Alex Garland's response to that was, well, that is that journalist's subjective answer. And so they believe that, and that's fine and valid. So here's my subjective answer, which basically the thing that he's criticizing in the movie is the idea of the relativity of truth. And he believes that there's a way to do journalism that is purely objective. That I think a lot of other sort of like, this is really like sort of like the death knell of resistance liberalism, like the sort of like post 2016 like reaction to Donald Trump, which is funny that he's basically doing the same thing that Rudy Giuliani said about Trump in 20. He said Trump shouldn't have to testify in 2018, basically because that truth is relative. but it's just like so unintelligent. And he also talks about, like, he has this idea that fascism is a movable left or right wing concept, which if you know history and have read a book, you know that that's not true. That it's a historically a right wing ideology.
Yeah.
But it's important to him to kind of equivocate between these two positions because it gives this idea that in the movie, there's more direct, the only direct political reference is Nick Offerman's character, right? He's this kind of avatar for Donald Trump. But then throughout the film, there are these other sort of like nods to whether they're aesthetic choices, right? There are scenes with guys who are in Hawaiian shirts and facial hair and fatigues and body armor and tactical gear, which is definitely a reference to like the Boogaloo aesthetic.
Yeah.
And then at one point they use the word Portland Maoists and the Antifa massacre with no further detail. He doesn't extrapolate any of those political ideas because in the solution to the problem of a potential civil war, like he said, is to vote and to not vote in certain people. But also it does this like he this is kind of a random question, but you watched I believe I heard you mention that you watched the Fallout TV adaptation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
And not to spoil it for your listeners, I guess they should probably, you know, skip ahead on this. But
spoiler warning, but I'm sure they've all seen it.
Yeah. At this point, there's at the end of that series, there's a really interesting, very on the nose, but very good. I liked the Fallout TV show. I thought it was very good in a lot of ways. And one thing that it was able to capture is something that happens, especially in the early games, the games that don't really involve Bethesda, have this understanding of the political that I think is enlightening, like regardless of the time period that you're in. And then the TV show, that's all summed up by the speech that Kyle MacLachlan gives at the end, which is juxtaposed against these shots of the New California Republic and the Brotherhood of Steel in the Fallout sense. There's always at the end of at least the more contemporary games, there's two of the factions. There's this big battle basically at the end of the game between the two factions. Depending on how you align yourself within the game is like what part of that sequence of events that you end up seeing, as well as it affects, you know, the sort of the way that you play the game. But in the TV show, Kyle MacLachlan is giving basically this speech he's basically giving a radical centrist speech.
Uh-huh.
And he shows that the results of this sort of like perceived centrist liberal democracy is much more fascistic than I think people... I think in a way that people often take for granted. He poses it as this, the problem is factionalism. And the problem is this, all of those bad people. And what we need to do is have our people in our little vault. And it basically sets up this idea that, like, the bad thing is the explicit violence of these quote unquote extreme factions, AKA people who believe in things and fight for them. The real good thing is the implicit violence of the liberal democratic political formations that all of their violence is implied and internal. It's all exercised through like mechanisms of control and restraint. And I think that's what's so interesting about what Fallout managed to do, at least on the sort of the political side of things, able to sort of like directly state and criticize that sort of centrist idea by saying, look, like obviously this is wrong too. And it's maybe worse in some ways because it doesn't actually have a political platform that you can like nod toward. But really it's more of the same implicit violence, more the implicit violence of the same, which is the problem in like contemporary American politics, right? The retreat back toward this like, acceptable level of internal strife or difficulty. And that, you know, if you have a good class politics, you understand like, well, the problem is capitalism. And he says that as much, like he talks about how he's like, I'm in that Pod Save America interview. He's like, I don't like free market politics. I don't like free market politics. But then he talks about how the audience for this film, he believes is center right wing people because you have to win elections. And that's when we start to realize that he's like John from Horror Vanguard put it really well in our group chat, that Alex Garland is basically, he's not just like a Lib Dem in the UK, like the Lib Dem party, but he's like a Lib Dem in the 1990s, which is intensely bad. Really, really insidious and evil in its like ability to present itself as acceptable and good while continuing a lot of the same implied violence that we're
absolutely
all very familiar with.
Yeah. Okay. I got some ideas cooking here. Allow me to interject for a moment because I think you just painted a really interesting broad picture of the first arc of what's going on here. I'm gonna bring it back to exactly the point you just made, but I want to roll back a little bit. So what's so confusing about this movie, I think, is that you have A24. A24 is kind of an interesting thing that almost everyone is familiar with now. They make artistic movies. What an interesting idea, you know. It exists in reaction to the fact that the market of making films had been kind of hollowed out to a point where you can only make blockbusters if you are using intellectual property that sells a bunch of toys and shit that everyone knows that's an easy investment for, you know, fucking studios and sponsors and stuff. Or you make an indie film, but it's like small and there's not enough budget. So A24 came along and they're like, we're going to do an experiment. We're going to take a little risk here. We're going to be an auteur based like production thing, art house, whatever the fuck you want to call it. And it has this massive cultural success. Suddenly everyone knows an A24 film that they love. Yeah. You've got your Hereditaries, your Ari Asters and stuff. And these Alex Garland films and things. And he's made some good films. Like I was confused by this because I was like, like I remember Annihilation. It was cool. It kind of reminded me of A Color Out of Space, the H.P. Lovecraft story.
Sure,
and you know, the other ones you mentioned, Ex Machina and stuff like that. It's surprising that this guy's dumb. Cause you think auteur, you think somebody's really good at something. They must be, one of us. Right. And then you go, oh shit. Maybe that's not true. Maybe there's just this thing that I'm always yelling about on Twitter, which is like, just because somebody's technically good at something, just because they're good at the craft, doesn't mean the meaning goes along with it, right? Yep. This is kind of a profound example of that, because it's simultaneously, like you said, this is A24 like deciding to make a blockbuster film, which is kind of like in conflict a little bit with kind of their mission statement of being this like auteur house thing. Right. Yeah. So I think that's just funny because it made it a huge movie to have this much of a fucking contradiction at the heart of. But it doesn't really matter. This could have been a lower budget thing or a more subtle thing. It's just that this profound bad point had an exclamation put on it because of that. Right. Yeah. The rollout to it makes it seem like the press rollout made it seem as though they were going to address politics in it in so many ways. They would, you know, they promoted it with this map of the United States that had all of the different factions laid out, specifically along those state borders, you know, which is really interesting. And then everyone goes, why the fuck are California and Texas in this alliance known as the Western Forces in this film? Wow, I want to go watch that to see how they explain how that happened. And then you watch it and it isn't, they don't state it. It's not in there. Maybe at best you could argue that it's like a zone of interest type thing where it's like in the background of this extremely under the microscope individual story.
Yeah.
But it's not enough for you to understand what they're trying to say about why this faction allied with that faction or whatever. And it seems that he doesn't really have an argument. He's just like, because like you said, factionalism just is the problem that he wants to address in general. Doesn't matter who's a faction or why, you know. So anyways, with all that in mind, you know, I was watching this and it reminded me of something I read a long time ago that I went back over, which is this this philosopher named Carl Schmitt, who you may be familiar with. Are you
A bit, yeah.
I'm not super familiar with him, but I read something a long time ago that I thought was kind of interesting. And to give away the point here, though, Carl Schmitt is really interesting because he wrote a lot of criticisms of liberalism. And then he was a Nazi. So This is, you always have to put a bunch of asterisks out when you discuss something like this. I think Nazis are bad, and I don't care who I offend when I say that. All right. But the thing that's
controversial take. Right?
But what's interesting about philosophers like Carl Schmitt and about fascists and about reactionaries in general is they're not bad because they're 100% brimming like with evil DNA and you should just never think about them or yada, yada, yada. They're bad because they took the wrong path. You know, What I mean by that is that some of his criticisms of liberalism are very apt. It's his conclusions that he draws from them that are bad and that would be a thing that you should comment on and when you make a film like this, if you understand that. But I think, you know, a lot of people in the liberal mind, especially, is afraid to go there. So fuck it. I'll go there for you. Right. So what Carl Schmitt criticized about liberal societies that he said made them like weak in certain ways was kind of based on this like God is dead argument. He talked about how pre the liberal bourgeois revolutions, you had kings, you know, you had like despots and authoritarian sovereigns, and their societies were often strong in the sense that when you have a sovereign who just makes authoritarian decisions, those decisions get done and, you know, they're bad. And there's a reason that we have revolutions that sort of ousted that system because it's bad when someone has too much power, but there is efficiency to them. And what he sort of criticizes in liberal societies is he's not saying it's bad that we no longer have sovereign power. He's kind of saying we still do have sovereign power. What's bad is that we don't understand it as such. We have governments like our own, like the United States, that in a threatening enough circumstance will send in the National Guard on its own people.
Yeah.
It will do things that are authoritarian and despotic, but only in those specific situations. And in the rest of the time, we're sort of living in this cloud of like an illusion where politics is something that happens in a big, weird building downtown and not something that every human is intrinsically connected to. And he's saying that haze that we live in between the times when things get really crazy is actually like a really real problem with liberalism, because it gives people the individual sort of like option to convince themselves that they can opt out and that it's a thing that is only voting and stuff like that. And that creates like a complacency within just the citizenry of liberal society. And, you know, obviously from there, that's when he becomes a Nazi and he's like, so what we need to do is make this like ultra, you know, fucking like cultural authoritarian regime that you worship and that fills the meaning hole inside of you, right? And yeah. Now you have an organized citizenry that isn't lost in this like liberal fog like people in liberal societies are, and it just like vies for power, because the power the goal of fascism is kind of similar to the goal of liberalism in that it's like to create just a cohesive, no factionalism. If you have successful fascism, you don't have factionalism, right? Everyone just has to be in the one party that you decide is the fucking thing. With liberalism, the fear of factionalism, it's interesting. It's like contradictory, because it's sort of arguing, well, society can be this thing where we have all these different factions, but they get along to a certain extent. They, meet in the political arena, and at the end of the day, well, we vote and then, you know, we do whatever the voting says and stuff like that. But that's like, it's kind of impossible like to maintain that sort of that stasis. And when it's threatened by real power, it just goes ahead and stops being liberalism to begin with, being liberalism altogether. Because if you're threatened by something like, you know, J6 or something like that, like the things that Alex Garland is reflecting on, the threat of an actual right wing fascist thing, you know, it kind of has to drop the pretense that it was ever kind of fair and tolerant to begin with and put that threat down. So what he's saying with this movie is kind of confusing because he's coming from a place of like the liberal mind in the all too recent, you know, past, and saying that here's a picture of some horrible future that we've gotten to potentially. And then there are these questions in the air kind of hanging of like, how would you prevent that? And what would you do in this situation to fix it? And I don't know, voting doesn't seem to really make sense even in his movie, like to answer either of those questions, you know? I'm lost in my philosophical sauce here. So feel free to bail me out and interject. No, but
you brought up a bunch of really good points. The first one being, and this it's a point that we can touch on briefly, but we have a tendency to reduce the production of a film. It's very easy to reduce it to authorial intent, right? Which the criticisms of authorial intent, which for listeners who aren't English academics or whatever, I'm not an English academic either. All my degrees are in history, which is why you're bringing up Carl Schmitt, I think is a good thing. It's this tendency toward like the prime motivator of a particular text and our interpretation of it can be reduced to the intentions of the author. So if we can make some kind of a determination as to what the author was intending for us to understand about the text or what they were intending to say about the text, then that can really sort of help us. That's the sort of like kernel of the truth of the text. I'm probably not explaining that very well, but like where the problem runs into that, first of all, is with the sort of A24 model, right? When we extrapolate, like, you know, say a good Marxist would do, understanding the production of Civil War within the context of a kind of mode of production, a mode of production that then creates and enforces a particular image of the social world, and then that image is reflected back in culture. And then it kind of acts in this, at least in our contemporary sort of capitalistic, if I'm being a like a fucking dispensationalist when it comes to capitalism, which I sometimes am. In this moment, we're particularly consumed by this kind of feedback loop between those three ideas, which I think is where Garland kind of, you know, gets a little hoisted by his own petard, if you will. A24, after coming off of the success of Everything Everywhere All at Once, as well as the sort of like cultural successes of directors like Robert Eggers, someone who I'm probably my favorite director who's working right now, who all of his movies, I believe, were produced by A24. A24 is a production company, and what they want to do is they want to make popular movies that make money. They want to do so in such a way that is reflective of culture in a way that people can interpret, as well as a way that like A24 allows people to feel smart because they feel like they understand like the symbol of a certain body of work is the way that they can sort of project their own understanding of film culture. And like, I make no moral claims about any of this, right? This is just, I'm just, you know, sort of saying things as they are.
Sure.
So what's interesting about Civil War is not just, you know, what Alex Garland wants us to think about it, but what it says as, in the way that American culture is currently making films, and not just in the, you know, we've seen there's a ton to be said about the actual production of a film, as we saw in sort of like the labor conflict of last year with the writer's strike and IATSE and all of that stuff. But in this case, what I'm most interested in is how Civil War is reflective of a particular time period in American culture. How do we historicize it? And you bring up Carl Schmitt, and I think that's really interesting because Schmitt was largely reflecting on the attempts at stabilization of the interwar period in Weimar Germany. And that was like, it was a period of great flux where people didn't really like, were sort of grappling with the ideas of liberal democracy. And Schmitt was basically arguing the idea that sovereignty and dictatorship are not just like compatible with a vision of democracy, but that they are imminent in those democratic institutions, and that they can't really exist without the sovereign decision can't exist without the body of people in which it is making the decision. And in the case of the United States, what I find most interesting about Civil War is how it's reflective of, just as you were describing, there is this and as we were talking about earlier, and this kind of like the implicit versus explicit vision of political violence or political conflict, that the implicit view of violence in the American context is something that goes all the way back. You can look at American culture, especially films, like right before 9/11 and then after 9/11, first of all, it has this kind of films after 9/11 or culture, American culture in general after 9/11, popular culture was had to sort of smooth out the sort of rough edges of the questions of the 1990s as to like, who's the external enemy. American like culture in our contemporary moment is always framed or reflected back against a perceived external enemy. And the main sort of driving force of changes in American culture is anxiety, the anxieties that are reflected back from the fear of that external enemy. After 9/11, there was a, like, we have to sort of like, no pun intended, literally and figuratively rally the troops around a particular American national identity. So the sort of like Toby Keith anthem that's then reflected in the war films that are, on the one hand, sometimes posing maybe weak critiques of what they're depicting. I think maybe, like, just off the top of my head, maybe Catherine Bigelow is probably a good example of this. But that are ultimately reaffirming the necessity of the institutions that preserve a particular way of life in the mind of Americans. In the case of Civil War, it is like Alice Garland uses journalism as a way of reflecting on its ultimate, like, not to get too fucking Freudian or whatever, but sort of like the death drive at the core of certain elements of American culture that is trying to, that's basically this conversation between attempting to socialize and maintain a particular order against the anxious feelings of finitude in that same social order. Mostly what it makes me think of is Americans' reaction to the assassination of Osama bin Laden. Uh-huh. Which what's interesting is that it just last year, the Washington Post submitted a bunch of FOIA requests, and they brought up about, I think, like 900 internal pictures of the White House during the killing of bin Laden. Obama talked about it in one of his memoirs. There's a really long oral history in Politico that is kind of interesting. It gives a little bit of a sort of a vision into the anxieties around the assassination of bin Laden as this kind of spectacle. I remember as being old enough to understand, to remember the way that people talked about 9/11 after it happened, as well as the way that people commented on the death of Osama bin Laden. They use very similar language, basically, like, and like the same thing with like the Challenger exploding, right? You will always know where you were when you heard about that news.
Uh-huh.
There's this kind of libidinal urgence at the center of this movie that is fantasizing about being present at the assassination of Osama bin Laden, that we can see that's been reflected on, you know, we remember, like, we've heard all the sort of like funny, like more mimetic things that came from his assassination, like that he played Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2, and he watched the Pope blast cigs video or yeah. whatever. And he had like, he was into like weird pornography or whatever, which none of that's all that surprising to me. I mean, when you're stuck inside of a house all the time, you're going to watch weird videos on the internet and play video games.
My favorite is that supposedly he played Final Fantasy VII, but I almost don't believe because it's like too on the nose. And I know that they maybe yeah. also like faked some of this stuff for reasons, you know?
Yeah. Or it gets kind of lost in the,
Believe that one.
That's, I mean, I think that's actually a really important part of it, right? Like, we are all sort of like imagining, or like culture is urging us to kind of imagine this moment as this kind of decisive affirmation of the post 9/11 American project long after we were fucking worn out by the war in Iraq, right? This is like, I was in college. I think he was assassinated in 2010. It affirms this idea externally in this case, because we're still coming off of those conflicts and trying to trying to like internalize and forget about Iraq and Afghanistan because there were still troops in both of those places. But ultimately that like when the bad guy is out, things will get better. And I think just everyone pretty much besides the most committed of like the nascent resistance lib movement understood this, and understood that it is very deeply ideological, and that we have some, that even I think those resistance lib have some nagging sense that this return to quote unquote normalcy of the post 2008 crises, it doesn't represent much more than a return just like that to the kind of, buried and like the sort of like anxious burying of the American death drive under the like very loose stability of capitalist crisis, right? Like the normalcy of the 2008 economic crises, right? Where like I was in the middle of college and I see the economy falling apart, and that gives rise to things like Occupy. And we remember, like, we have all of these memories, right, of that, of the Arab Spring or whatever. I think what Alex Garland mostly understands is that he believes Trump bad. And the more Trump is bad, it's the easier way to imagine how this movie was always going to end, which is through the spectacle of the journalist. They use in the film, they use like it is not just like the imagined lens of how a journalist approaches these ideas. They talk about, they have these like long, deep conversations about what it means to be a journalist while there's gunfire going on in the background, while one character is talking about how excited he is to go straight into it and how the other one is warning. Like there's these two sort of like parental figures. One on the one hand is this sort of like libidinal drive toward the violence, and on the other hand, the other one is Kirsten Dunst's character, who gives a very good performance. All the performances in the movie are very good; they're very well acted.
I would say a lot of times, sometimes a line would fall flat, and I'd be watching an actor and going, "It's not the actor's fault. That line was fucking bad. The writing is the problem."
Yeah, I completely agree. Because it's like you said, I think one thing about Garland, like my sort of like take on Alex Garland is pretty much as you described it, which is that like if you have the smallest amount of like if you have a decent artistic eye and then way too much confidence that what you're doing is intelligent and good, you can probably make a really decent movie that people will watch. And I think that's what
what's so frustrating about this is that there's like Dunning-Kruger shit going on, but also with the audience. So there are people for whom like they kind of are on the same wavelength as him as Americans. And so people are going to think this is dumb. People are going to think this is a really smart movie, which is frustrating if you're like both the artist and the audience are wrong. Cause that raises some interesting questions of like, does it even matter what you think then, you know, or are you just ruining people's good time or whatever? But like, I think they're both wrong in certain ways.
It's just what it does more than anything is it affirms that sort of anxiety that I was talking about. This like there's another really honest Donald Trump's press release. I don't know if we remember this when after the assassination of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, he released a press release that was very much in his voice and honestly really funny.
Yeah.
Where he's like, it was really great. I got to watch most of it. And there's one of the useful things about Donald Trump is that he just says the fucking thing. He doesn't have he maybe does now more than he used to because he's a little more handled than he used to. He's also a little, you know, lost his grip a little more. But he understood that like the political spectacle was the thing that people needed to understand. And what his supporters, who are extremely jingoistic, very nationalistic, despite his like people were worried about during the presidential campaign how he was like, oh, Trump's a little more dovish than, you know, his like, and that's only in affect and in language. He's not actually any more dovish than any other like absolutely rabid psycho Republican. Like he just doesn't sit on the board of Boeing like Nikki Haley does. Yeah. I wrote a very bored and drunk blog post about my takes on the weird Republican primary. And just the thing that made me laugh the most is I could not find the actual quote, but at one point Nikki Haley said And I quote, about the Boeing Corporation, this is right before Boeing started to have a lot of problems, is that she was, quote, proud of them, which I thought was really, really funny. That's a real quote that I watched too much fucking C-SPAN footage to go back and remember it. But like, our political leaders or whatever are indebted to this exact same, like, this feeling of what used to, the energy that used to be spent on the external conflict is being turned inward. And now all of a sudden everyone is getting even more anxious than the January 6th, which you mentioned was the sort of like big, like rise and anxiety from the liberal center left. In that, like, there is it, they were able to see that there is a possibility for the disruption of their sort of natural day-to-day understanding of politics. But what they don't seem to understand is that the repressive apparatuses of liberal democracy, which are seen as good, is, has, and always shall be, which is, it's the justice system, it's the police, it's the court system, it's prisons. These institutions that have embedded themselves as necessary positive forces in the world are the governing apparatus that liberals almost always end up coming to rely on. That's why it's directly in conversation with all this stuff about the military. When the conflict is external and abroad, it gives a chance in the metropole, if you will, like it's not an imperial power, but it back within the sort of the center of power in the home country, to reinforce that national identity, which is completely inbound with post-industrial capital, as we know. It allows that to reinforce itself, to make itself as real and as human and as relatable. It's when, you know, when people talk about after 9/11, we all came together. Yes, we all came together to go kill millions of Iraqis, right. Millions of Iraqi children.
That's why one of the most jarring scenes in this movie, arguably the only really kind of good scene, still bad in my opinion, though, is this thing that happened where they come upon this kind of odd, almost boogaloo looking, Jesse Plemons character. Yeah. And two characters, you know, get sort of like too close to him and caught up in what he's doing. And what we see, what him and his other friend, soldier, whatever the fuck are doing, is they're assisting with dumping a truckload of bodies into a mass grave. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that one of the characters through the interaction they have with him, like, falls in it, and it's very jarring, and it speaks to this like libidinal thing we're talking about with cameras and lenses and stuff like that. But like in the theater, I'm watching this and I'm like, this is being presented through this movie as unimaginably horrifying. Yeah. And what's so frustrating is it's unimaginably horrifying to audiences of this movie because the people in the movie are white, or the people in the bodies in the grave in the movie are white Americans. But this is like so frustrating given that this is literally happening in Palestine right now. And the same country's culture, the same people, the same lens is telling you that doesn't matter. It just process this entirely differently. So raises this question, why is it horrifying when it's white Americans, and why is it like when it's elsewhere, it's almost the reverse, like you're a bad person if you empathize with that, you know? Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing I think that happened in that scene is, so there's two Asian guys who are like Asian American, but they're journalists, so they're friends of our protagonists who are in that scene, and at one point Jesse Plemons with the little red sunglasses and stuff that make him extra threatening because he's a little, you know, the alt-right is a little kooky. They're boogaloo guys. They wear, you know, the fucking Hawaiian shirts and stuff. He's going around, he's interrogating everyone and asking them where they're from. And they're all getting really nervous because they know if you answer this wrong, you might get shot, which is what happens. And everyone who answers, you know, I'm from Florida, I'm from Missouri, they get spared, because if you remember the map that they explain, not in the movie, but elsewhere, that's the, you know, the weird Trump, evil rebel section of the country. And when they get to one of the Asian guys, he starts freaking out because he knows, he's going to answer this wrong. Honestly, I don't know why he didn't just lie and say, I'm also from Florida, but, This stuck out to me so much. He says he's from Hong Kong, and then the alt-right Jesse Plemons guy fucking kills him. And what made me crazy about that, and made me realize, like, all the things that Alex Garland doesn't understand, is that I think I would argue in reality, an alt-right guy is pro-Hong Kong, because Hong Kong is the fucking capitalist part of China. And, like, if you remember, like, the Hong Kong uprising against the government there, it was against the Chinese government, and there was a lot of alt-right support of it. There was a lot of weird institutional, like, deep state support of it, because it's a Cold War thing. It was like, right. No, we got to support the fucking liberalized people against the communist, you know, authoritarian, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't even fucking bog down on that. We had a whole controversy with it on this podcast, but, like, but, like, to me, that took me out of the movie for a minute, because I was watching Alex Garland going, this motherfucker literally doesn't understand the enemy he's trying to make a movie about. He thinks that the alt-right in the United States are, like, based, they're nationalists in the sense that they're based on, like, being from America, which is, like, part of it. But they're capitalists. They love capitalism, and they perceive their enemies as enemies of capitalism. That's why they call us neo-Marxist, postmodern, whatever, and stuff like that. And that's just so I reduced the fraction watching that and was going, yeah, okay. So what this guy is trying to say is he thinks that everything that happened recently in history with Trump and everything like that is because dumb right-wing people are just, like, too, you know, they're too radical. That's all it can kind of come down to. If you don't understand, it has to do with the mode of production.
He doesn't understand the complexities of the, like, psychotic race science that these people have twisted, the pretzel race science pretzel that these people have twisted themselves into. And he makes the mistake. One thing that he does that I don't know why. Actually, I do know why, but it's just funny how this is the thing that really pisses me off the most, is that in that Pod Save America interview, he talks about, he does this thing where he and the other fucking host or whatever look each other's assholes for about 5 minutes talking about how they have Republican friends. Alex Garland is like, I happen to have friends. Oh, I happen to have friends who disagree with me politically. And some of them even voted for Donald Trump. And, like, I'm from fucking Central Florida. Like, I didn't know a Democrat growing up, and in my mind, I'm just like, yeah, man, I am a normal fucking person, and I too know someone who is a Republican. Like, I'm not so up my own fucking Hollywood ass that I understand that there are different people out there in the world, and they have different, but they're so proud of themselves for understanding that, oh, their motivations are complicated. Yet then their understanding of the world is that, oh, well, you know, he's like, yeah, because they're all Chinese or whatever. And they do this, and he does the, like, oh, I wanted to do an offensive version of his accent, but it's good. I'll embarrass myself a little more, too much than that. But he's like, yeah, he even talks about in that interview is like, you know, I get afraid when people do the Hillary Clinton basket of deplorables thing. Yeah, which was a really one of the dumbest political moves that anyone has done in the history of ever. Like, to get in front of a whole bunch of TVs and then give, like, the most annoying blowhard candidate that you're running against that you should be able to beat, but, you know, you just refuse to go to Michigan and Wisconsin or whatever, turn the buses around, yeah. Giving him more ammunition to make you look exactly like the person everyone knows that you are. Because
also,
you don't
also just a weak insult, I have to comment. Yeah. Basket of deplorables. What do you get? Get a roast writer. Come on, you know?
A basket, like an Easter like a wicker basket on the front of a bicycle.
This is exactly how an old lady would roast you. It really You're a basket.
Just like he criticizes the thing that he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the more than anything, like my fucking soapbox about conservative cultural identity is that none of these liberals in Hollywood understand the cultural signifiers of right-wing people who, like, the shows that are directly next to their movies and streaming platforms and stuff like that. They don't understand it. They still, his idea of contemporary conservatism is very simplistic and very flat. It's very of, like, it's basically like the 2016, 2017 Pod Save America crowd, The center right is good. Everyone else is racist and stupid, which, yeah, a lot of them are racist and stupid, but a lot of it's America. A lot of people are fucking racist and stupid. They don't understand the, I want to ask Alex Garland if he has seen the, this is something I beat this drum on podcasts all the time. And maybe I need to actually make a video essay about it whenever I have time, but I have a small child, so I don't have time for anything anymore. But there is the defining cultural text of the post 2016 Trump era is it's Yellowstone. And I, coming from an extremely conservative family in a part of Florida that is unbelievably excited about Donald Trump, any chance that they get, there's a rodeo in town and he did a rally at the arena and he broke a record for attendance by like literally like five times its capacity. People were spilling out into the road to go see him. He doesn't I want to ask Alex Garland if he has taken a second to try and understand the particularities of conservative cultural anxiety these days, because he doesn't seem to really understand the move toward the frontier that's been happening in culture that Yellowstone perfectly encapsulates. It's this cultural signifier of property as intimate and family relations, of generational anxiety. Conservatives are afraid of legacy and of losing their particular vision of their, it's reactionary. It's based off of a version of history that never actually existed, but that they take reactionary ideology like fascism takes actually existing history and kind of breaks it up and rearranges it in a particular fashion that allows people to, you know, find within them some internal affirmation of their own identity. And that identity is always very conservative, very right wing, often very defensive of the rights of private property in the case of America. It's moving toward these sort of like horizontalist points of political engagement. It's sort of like libertarian ideology that every once in a while is that when you find yourself being like, yeah, leaving some people alone in certain ways is good. And when government does some things in a certain way, it's bad. Corporate power unchecked is not good. Crony capitalism, as they call it, is, you know, if you think capitalism is bad, you should see crony capitalism, really. I have a brain. I agree that that's not good for a majority of people because I can see and hear things. But like, he's so disconnected from what's actually going on in conservative culture in such a way that like it's almost remarkable the way he seemed to lack understanding of this kind of turn toward the frontier, the kind of conservative anxiety that actually is like resulting in some isolationist, stuff that's, you know, dressed up and usually called populism, some sort of version of, you know, an alternative version of governance that definitely is perfectly fine with capitalism, 100% perfectly fine with capitalism, but is not okay with the way that power is wielded in a particular sense. And I just, what's so infuriating about civil wars attempt to try and define some kind of oppositional element, but without doing so in any like explicit terms, is that it demonstrates that it neither understands left-wing quote-unquote extremism or right-wing extremism in any meaningful sense, but is instead indebted to this. And I was talking about the change in American culture. I have this other thing that I talk about on podcasts a lot that I find the sort of the cultural affect of center left culture, the affect of center left culture is often this idea of affirmation and self-realization. It's about being it's Katy Perry, you're a firework. I talk about Katy Perry way too much.
She's been doing interesting things on Twitter. I don't know if you saw.
Oh no, I haven't. But I'm
took a picture with a Cybertruck that Elon gave her. Also, she follows me for some reason. I don't understand.
Oh, I'm super jealous.
I've yet to slide into her DMs, but I'm thinking about it.
she did this. She has this like She's one of the last like remaining pop stars that is explicit, that was explicitly by committee. All pop stars are by committee, but now there are close personal friends, right? Uh-huh. So I have to go online to defend Taylor Swift when she puts out a really bad record because she's my close personal friend and everyone else is internalized misogyny. Twitter has been like old Twitter recently. It's like they never changed the name. It's very funny to me.
Yeah.
All of the, anything you say to any of this stuff is literal violence. You can't talk about anything without actually doing violence to someone because you offended a pop star or whatever. Katy Perry wasn't like that. Like for a long time, it was all of her stuff was clearly like by committee. She had like clearly had creative input, but she used to make, for example, she made music videos. For every music video that she made, they would also do a behind the scenes. And she would talk very clearly to the camera and talk about what the label wanted and what the label did. Underneath all of this, like ideologically underneath all of this is this like, self-realization and self-affirmation cultural affect that I find to be incredibly fascistic. Instead, you substitute a reimagined historical configuration of some particular, say, national or ethnic identity, and you substitute it with self-affirmation. Finding yourself, realizing yourself is the way that it's the bottleneck of meaning. And so you can actually self-affirm yourself. You can do self-care in the name of the nation, which is just kind of how, like, I think that's kind of moving out a little bit. And now it's either, you know, all pop stars are your close personal friend and their problems are your problems. And you're in the army that goes online and defends them. Uh-huh. Or there's a kind of like emerging cynicism that's undergirding some more emergent culture from people who are, you know, 15 years younger than me or whatever. But I find that to be the like truly at the core of what Alex Garland, like if you can reduce the goal to what Alex Garland wants, it's for people to, you know, vote with their. Like is to realize that who they are is a good voter. I'm using Katy Perry. Like, there's a reason why she's pretty conservative in her political views, and she was like a libertarian or whatever. She grew up in a relatively similar environment than I did. Very religious, very conservative. But that, like, Hillary Clinton was her politician for a reason. It's because that campaign was all about like, you are special. You're a special, important, super special, wonderful, good person. It's, you know, like, it's what's the, there's a meme that people are like, the person who bullied you in high school is currently going to therapy and they're like, you just need to take some time for yourself. Other people are really calling other people toxic when someone who like bullied you mercilessly.
Yeah.
Like that's the American affect. That's the cultural ideology of centrism on the left and the right. So yeah, Alex Garland, that's in my mind, that's what he's trying to do with his move. His politics.
I think you nailed it. And this is so odd that it came that we figured out via Katy Perry, but that's an excellent parallel because as you say, like Katy Perry's the last, how'd you put it? By like,
pop star by committee.
By committee, right? She's, this is before things become extremely parasocial and, pop stars are now your friends and podcasters are your friends and everything that you subscribe to your fucking toilet and that's your friend and you follow it and look at its Instagram and stuff. Right. But one of the reasons that she is because she came out of like the fucking Christian world.
Yeah. She was in Acquire the Fire. She performed at Acquire the Fire was like the Pentecostal. It was they were Pentecostal, but they were attempting to not. Marking themselves as Pentecostal. I went to Acquire the Fire one time. People were speaking in tongues and stuff. It was like worship services for youth groups and stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure. I bet. Because before Taylor Swift was your friend, before the podcast that you love was your friend, God was your friend, which is exactly what Carl Schmitt and Nietzsche are fucking talking about when they talk about this loss of meaning that occurs after a while, when you get away from this like authoritarian thing where the king is your friend because he talks to God, who's his friend, and stuff like that. And, there's a gap in between having things that rule the meaning of our lives, like religions, and having this liberal world where, as Schmitt said, was like by by design, there's a barricade put on how much power those things can have. By design, we create kind of a secular world when we create liberal society, because we're, you know, the Enlightenment is a bunch of people getting together and go, that went pretty bad when we let it turn into a thing where there's crusades and stuff, because there's too much meaning, there's too much cultism in worshiping these fucking kings and stuff, and then getting, you know, into wars and stuff over it. And so there's this gap between when things retake that meaning. And for, you know, I'd say what's actually happening with Americans and with like the far right and stuff like that is that they went ahead and picked some things to fill in that meaning. And we all have, because we're in kind of a choose your own adventure situation where yeah. It's like, just pick which thing is your God now, you sort of worship or whatever. But the liberals, like Alex Garland, kind of are trying to paper over the contradiction by worshiping the liminal space in between the meanings, right? Yeah. In between it being God, and in between it for far right people being like the market in the 1950s, and you know, the fascist cloud that sort of ties all that together. He's trying to kind of say, like, yeah, no, there is a meaning. It's voting for the Democrats every 4 years incrementally to make the world good. And like, most people at this point have kind of taken that for bullshit. Even a lot of people that used to buy into it, because they were people who, like, you know, lived as liberal society tells you, mostly just in their own world, and then sort of like get to just do that, you know, at once every 4 years when you vote, the same way like a lot of Christians near the end of, you know, Christianity having a lot of power, go to church on Sunday or just once a year when they go home to, you know, see their parents or whatever. It increasingly becomes like a ritual that you go, okay, you know, I do it, and it almost hoards off the fucking void that then the fascism would like come to fill, you know.
Alex Garland, just to say that Alex Garland actually affirms your point explicitly in the Pod Save America interview, where he describes what he believes is the ideal is that the center right and the center left change power every few years. He just came out and said it.
Yeah, that's bad, Alex.
It's not great, man. It's not great.
But like, I think you made such an interesting point about how like when he says, I have Republican friends, and you as a listener who's way more radical than him to the left go, yeah, I do. I have more. Like, I grew up surrounded by these people. Same. I grew up in Texas. You know, like, the reason I'm like this is because I grew up in the belly of the beast, and I like know why these people are this way. He's got this interesting Dunning-Kruger sort of like a fallacy of reasoning where, I mean, first of all, he's casting everyone to the left of him as less tolerant than him in an interesting way. And that's not true, but it also shows that he venerates this idea of tolerance, which is at the center of the Schmitt critique I was talking about, where like the idea of tolerance of like, oh, we can have a political system where everyone's invited, and at the end of the day, we shake hands and go, I agree to disagree or whatever. That actually, you know, A, it doesn't work, and B, like, the story that he's trying to tell in Civil War is odd, because who is he, like, really implying caused all this if tolerance is a thing that keeps this sort of thing at bay? He must be casting the far left as the thing that was so intolerant that it created a world where we can no longer reach the far right and just get them to vote for Hillary Clinton or whatever. That's massively idealistic and immaterial and stupid. But it also sort of implies like all these contradictory things, because it's like, well, then shouldn't you be tolerant also of like, you're being intolerant in making these arguments? It's just a massive like black hole of contradictions, you know?
Yeah, I think you in terms of what he thinks is like what is to be done for Alex Garland, I think you're exactly right. There is no it's telling of the lack of political imagination from that set, because he's almost like, and this is where I think psychoanalysis comes in. Psychoanalysis is something that exists in order to like understand the most fundamental like limitations that are in so many ways outside of human control, right? That like the three discoveries of Freud, right? The three things that reminded humanity of its finitude: Galileo, Darwin, and Freud himself. Understanding that one, that the Earth is not the center of the universe, that human life is not exceptional or special, and that we are subjected to these unconscious or subconscious drives and desires that are ultimately our vision of the world and the world as it actually is, the capital R real, is something that we cannot obtain. We're always driving toward, on the one hand, the production of life and order, and on the other hand, a desire to return to, at least, you know, I'm less Freudian and more post-Freudian in that, you know, the representation of the pre-Oedipal. We desire to return to the mother in such a way. And people are really grappling with that. Alex Garland is grappling with that. That's the thing, is that he sees himself as above and beyond those particular, that's why they see themselves as enlightened, these sort of centrist ideological figures or cultural figures. Uh-huh. When in all actuality, they're doing the exact same thing that them or the fucking, you know, Brooklyn weirdos who are, you know, so intelligent that they can understand that the huge, remarkable cultural shift we're going through when we're, you know, focusing on now what's most important is a different part of Brooklyn and also Catholicism. Like this, this obsessive like authoritarian drive as its own particular like enlightened vision of the way that the world functions. When it's all in all actuality, it's just as libidinal and just as symbolic, and just as porous and alienating and subjective, literally in the production of the subject, as all the rest of it is. And at least the like right-wing weirdos can admit that they desire the thumb of the authoritarianism. The problem with the centrist liberal is that, just bring it all back, all that authoritarian desire is implied and also couched in all of this like language of, you know, it's not an illogical deference to the military. It's just a logical one instead.
You know? Right. That's what fucking Schmidt was talking about, was saying like, well, at least when you have like fascism, you have someone that's saying it for what it is. And mm-hmm. the thing with liberalism is that it has all of this like despotic authoritarian stuff, but it's all like through this haze of plausible deniability that it is what it is. It's kind of refreshing sometimes to talk to fucking far-right psychos, because they'll at least just say it out loud. The thing that a frustrating like Pod Save America guy like Alex Garland is he's arguing for bad shit, but he's got to couch it all in this weird reasoning and a sort of like Enlightenment era, you know, veneration of stuff like journalists and learning and academia and this and that. And I read the paper with my stupid coffee and I have an Obama hat on and I'm an NPR good citizen with a tote bag, that like more and more is, to anyone paying attention, a fucking veneer that is just like flimsy and not fucking true, you know? That's why
they love the NYPD just as much as the other group does. I'm not allowed to say fuck you. With the other group, I'm allowed to say fuck you because we're clearly in political conflict with one another. And I will fuck you. People who are organizing politically on the far right, go fuck yourself.
Like, right.
You know, you have a garbage nonsense like ideology that's like wrapped up in your own, like, I don't know, probably fucking castration anxiety at this point. Like, I just want to be able to speak to the thing, because that's actually reflective of our contemporary moment rather than this like really like, I don't know, just as you were saying, it's just very, it's very indebted to a particular kind of authoritarianism that you're not allowed to name because that's inappropriate when like, I don't know, like think of all of the fucking,
you know, the center right people, the fucking John Podoritzes or whatever his fucking name is right now, who are just all they're doing is tweeting about how the grave threat to everyone's safety that Columbia University students are posing, like, and that warranting calling the National Guard on them. Like there's no moment in history when the National Guard getting called to college campuses where anything, we simply don't remember if that has ever happened before. Was it bad? I don't remember, you know, like,
yeah. Well, the frustrating thing about liberals is the limits of their imagination by nature of the ideology. 'Cause you watch this fucking movie and you're like, okay, so some dickhead, like, centrist, radical centrist, center-right guy is painting a picture of the world that basically is his faction of center-right versus the far-right, and that's all that is possible to imagine. I mean, literally, like, the movie presents limitations on what it tells you is the universe, you know, arguably, in its movie. And it's just all that other stuff. Why is there such and such happening in Portland? Why was there something called the Antifa massacre? Was it pro or anti-Antifa who won? You know, that is, do not worry about it because it's irrelevant. And he's proposing to explain the far right in comparison to his own centrist values in this way that's, like, fucking frustrating because you – all, like, people like you can me and see is how similar they are. You go, okay, you're telling me the world is far right people and people who believe in far right shit but, like, have a blindfold on about it and go, I'm a fatalist about it and it's going to happen eventually anyway, but I was a good person about it, and that's sort of all you can do. And that's why you tell a story that's hyper individualized like this, that's just about some journalists, because that's, I guess, all you can get at the end of the day, because everything else to the left of you is like, you would, like, be silly to bring that up. It's like, you know, that's not possible unless it's a million years from now or whatever. I do, as we kind of round this out, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I knew I was going to get really mad at this movie, so I wanted to say something nice about it at the end, which is that I don't know if this is just the theater I went to, but the sound design was excellent.
Great sound design, good pacing. The film was paced. I get really, like, shitty about film pacing these days. Everything is either, like, so quick it's just dumping all the ideas in a bucket and forcing me to try and, you know, pour through and figure it out, or it's so drawn out, something is 3.5 hours long that needed to be an hour shorter. Like it intercuts its dialogue and its action in a way that kept my attention. I'll say that. That's nice.
The gunshots, and they, you know, it's weird because, like, every movie has guns in it. This is the thing I think about a lot. It's like, to the point of, like, I'm massively desensitized and bored by them in a lot of ways. But the way that the story holds so close to a bunch of people traveling in this very uncertain, like, 2020-esque vibe situation where the world is, you know, kind of over and kind of not. When a gunshot goes off, it feels like what that would feel like in real life when you're kind of, like, you're in a situation like what 2020 felt like, and you're uncertain, but you've been sitting around alone for so many hours. Okay, we'll go out and we'll play in that field, and then something happens that's actually scary and it makes you realize, oh shit, yeah, we should have been taking this more seriously the whole time, but that's difficult to do. Like, there was stuff like that that was like, I'll hand it to them, man, the gun sounded real good. They were very jarring.
They used blanks and squibs, congratulations. Or a lot of that good tension stuff was referential, right? Which there's nothing wrong with, you know, referencing other war movies or whatever, but, like, I could tell when it was Full Metal Jacket, it was Full Metal Jacket. It was like the sniper scene. Mm-hmm. Like, that was just Full Metal Jacket, which is, which is fine. He made that work for his own sort of, like, purposes. But I think the only thing that I have even left unsaid at this point is I was talking about Osama bin Laden. And one point that I forgot to bring up was that one of the other really good analogs to the particularly noxious ideology of this movie is the work of Aaron Sorkin. Obviously some of the guys who are on Pod Save America were literally, they were Obama speechwriters, and they also work for Aaron Sorkin. There is a porous relationship between the Aaron Sorkin universe and, the, like, liberal writers. It particularly for his
extremely stupid show, The Newsroom, which I have seen all of course. I'm a culture goblin. I can't help myself.
Yeah.
There is an episode of The Newsroom, which for people who haven't seen it, there, The Newsroom is borrowed directly from real life. It's basically, what if the news was good? So he takes stuff that already happened and attempts to try and like retell the story. If a, you know, a radical center right and a radical center left person teamed up, and the center teamed up and took on the right wing extremists. And they did stuff on Occupy in season two and stuff like that. And, you know, but there was an episode in season one that was specifically about the Osama bin Laden assassination. And there is a really telling scene, like in every Aaron Sorkin, TV show, and in most of his films too, everyone is the ultimate deference to be paid toward is the United States military. The United States military is the sort of like objective point on which we can all agree the military is good, even if we disagree about how we should use the military. The fact that America is has its hand on the world stage is ultimately a good and stabilizing thing, when the truth is the opposite. That stabilization is unto the particular national goals of the United States. It's, as we're seeing, as we saw through things like the rise of ISIS, that it actually ends up, you know, creating these power vacuums that result in more conflict, as U.S. military aid to all kinds of places, particularly what we're seeing with the conflicts in the Middle East right now, has this, it contributes to these root causes of all of these problems in a really essential and material way. But what mattered the most in that show, which is also about journalism, there's a whole, there's a whole HBO show that's, I can't get into that. there's a whole nother one too that I've of course watched. There's an episode of that show where the whole thing is about the just telling people that Osama bin Laden was killed. At one point, the central character played by Emily Mortimer says, "If I can let people know 1 minute sooner than I thought I could that he's dead, then I'll know I've done my job." At another point, one of the producers on the show, they're stuck on a plane on a tarmac because they're trying to desperately get to the newsroom so they can do the goddamn news. One of them recognizes that the pilot is wearing military stripes, and of course he knows it. He recognizes his stripes.
Oh, I remember
his
this.
Exact rank. Yeah, and he says, "Sir, I wanted to let you know, sir, that we assassinated Osama bin Laden for you, sir." In this, like, the ultimate like description of the post 9/11 anxiety. It was so telling, and the fact that it's still so prevalent. That it's at the root of this types of, it's at the root of this type of political imagination, I think says everything that people need to know about the, like, the political anxieties that are at the root of the creation of this film. Besides the fact that A24 really wanted a big movie and they did it, like they got their big summer blockbuster.
I think you're totally right. Because you have to be stunted in that way on a historical timeline at that point, because everything that comes after that is kind of the direct lead up to the story of then like Trump getting elected and stuff like that. And you have to be in complete denial about why Trump got elected, which is what the radical centrist point of view is just insisting that this is some aberration in a timeline that would have gone differently had this just thing not occurred, which is so weird and immaterial, and it doesn't understand that, you know, the right wing is like something that you can use like scientific method in a sense to like observe over time and predict and track and things like that. It's so fucking frustrating. As I mean, what I described is just basic left shit, basic intro to Marx and historical materialism and all that stuff. It's just the concept that that's possible, but they have to live in a world where it isn't. And like what I've got Schmidt brain right now, so I'm just going to go back to him one more time because I've been trying to like articulate this while I was thinking about this. But like he talks about this like paradox of like the insistence of liberalism as being this tolerant thing where everyone can get along in the abstract political sense and then go away. And he talks about this contradiction, which is that if a force appeared within a liberal society like that took power and then started doing things that weren't in keeping with tolerating everyone else, which is what we're describing in the threat of fascism and what he's painted the picture as having already happened in this movie, he's saying that then as the liberal society, you have a choice. And neither of those choices are in keeping with liberal ideology. One of them is to fucking react and fight back. And, you know, if you're going to get outvoted, you can't go, hey, are we going to have a vote on whether to fucking fight Donald Trump or fucking God, the guy from Parks and Recreation or whatever. Right. And the other one is what the fuck is the other one? I don't know. It's escaping right now, but it's equally not. So you're faced in a situation where you cannot vote the thing out or whatever. And what he's trying to say with this movie is like, that's already happened. What is the explanation for how they got out of that system or how they got into it? It doesn't seem to really make sense that he's arguing tolerance or voting or whatever, because they're spoiler. I mean, they eventually use this thing called the Western Forces that for some reason has a military, which I also didn't really understand, to just kill him. I don't know. Just war. And then it like everything just goes back to normal. Like, doesn't that create a situation where the threat of that happening exists all over again? Well, I think the implication is no. Fascism, bad people just happened once and they're like a fly in the ointment of this perfect system. I don't know. I'm going to cut myself off there, though, because I'll be doing this at a bar later over beers and trying to finish the points I'm making, which I always do with podcasts. But Kyle, thank you so much for coming on Pod Damn America. I am a fan of your stuff. And when I saw you tweeting about this, I was like, definitely want to talk to that guy and hear him explain things I don't understand about this film. So thank you for coming.
Anytime. Love the show. I'm really happy to be here. I appreciate it a lot.
Where can my listeners find you if they are not already fans?
Yeah, you can. I'm at Labor Kyle on a few things. I have a YouTube channel where I post essays that are sometimes about culture and sometimes melancholic reflections on my family. So if you want to get sad, youtube.com/LaborKyle. Otherwise, you can listen to Horror Vanguard or you can listen to All Gamers Are Bastards. Two very good shows with great co-hosts with whom I'm lucky to be affiliated. And yeah. That's where I am. Otherwise, I'll be screaming into a corner by myself about this movie in particular for another week, probably. So you can find me there, too.
Right there with you. cool. And as you probably are familiar, fans of our show, we have merch for sale at our Big Cartel shop. It's in the show notes. Getting some new shirts soon. Had a little problem with our merch thing, but it'll be something up there soon. I'm going on tour this weekend. I'm coming through the Southwest. I'll be at Dry Heat Comedy Club in Albuquerque and at Silver Something Cafe in Bisbee, way out in the middle of nowhere, and maybe in Vegas, just hanging out. Maybe I'll do a show. I don't know. It'll be thrown together last minute. Sign up for our Patreon if you're a fan of the show. I feel I should plug this more. This show is brought to you ad-free by our Patreon. Not by Patreon. Fuck them. Our Patreon. It keeps us alive, so I feel like I should plug it more. And we don't do ads because we're anti-capitalist. So please stop emailing me, trying to get me to sign up for Anchor Lite or whatever the fuck, where you plug ads into our show and then make money off of us barely making money. Listen to Anders' podcast, The Vanquished. It's very good. Listen to my other podcasts, Why You Mad? And that's my podcast, I Don't Know You, which is about King of the Hill. I think that's it. All right. Thank you, Labor Kyle.
Anytime.
It's finished.